Perhaps the dumbest career move Charles Grodin ever made was turning down the leading role in The Graduate. They were willing to pay him only $500 a week, and he was already getting twice that as a guest star on TV westerns. Dustin Hoffman negotiated the fee up to $750, and you know how that story ends. It took Grodin a long time to establish himself in films. He had supporting roles in Rosemary's Baby, Heaven Can Wait, and It's My Turn. In the years the movie roles weren't coming, he wrote, directed, and produced for TV and the theater. He also starred on Broadway in Same Time Next Year. Now Grodin is best known for his roles in The Heartbreak Kid, King Kong, The Lonely Guy, and last year's hit Midnight Run, in which he co-starred with Robert De Niro. Charles Grodin has written an autobiography called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. Although Grodin is now thought of as a comic actor, he didn't start out in comedies. One of his early auditions was for a TV action series called Hawk about an American Indian detective.
Oh, I was at the very beginning of my career. I think I was in my early 20s, and they had me come in. There was a new, I think it was CBS, had a new series, an adventure action series starring an American Indian detective called Hawk. I knew that he was a character that had a knife strapped to his leg under his pants, and that if he didn't like something you were doing, he would leap in the air and kick you in the face. And they were having me in to talk about being on this series, and I didn't know what part it was. So there were some people in there from the network and two or three people, and I was really raw. I hadn't done hardly anything, enough that they were interested in maybe be playing a part there. And they told me all about Hawk, how he was this American Indian, and he like leaped over this and threw people over that and mostly kicked you in the face. And then he told about this woman that he had an involvement with and another woman that he had an involvement with. And I was sitting there nodding my head and really hadn't said anything. And then they were looking at me as though they expected me to say something. And so I said, well, you know, it's interesting, but you've now described three parts to me, none of which I'm even remotely possible for. Why exactly are you telling me all this? And they said, well, what do you think an American Indian looks like? And I realized that they were actually talking to me about being Hawk, this Indian guy who kicks you in the face. So I did a real quick turn about thinking, God, I could be like a star of a big series and kick people in the face. He said, what do you think an American Indian looks like? I said, like me, exactly like me. But I think I paused too long, so they got the guy who was in the waiting room when I went out, Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, right. Now, you even played the heavy on an episode of The Virginian.
I played a lot of villains in westerns. I never left my feet and kicked anyone in the face, but I was in a lot of westerns. It was just necessity. I had co-authored and directed an off-Broadway musical, and we had a disastrous opening night because the costume lady hadn't been paid, and she stole the costumes. So the police had to go after her, and we just had a show that really looked like it was going to be a success. It was a disaster, and I had a baby daughter at the time, and I just had to make a living. And I went out to Hollywood and found that all they really had was dominated by westerns. So I became a cowboy, and I had never ridden a horse or anything, but there I was. I was this cowboy.
You were the bad guy a lot.
I was always the bad guy because the star was the hero.
Right. Were you good at being menacing?
Well, you know, after this was in 1966, 67, I went out there. By that time, I had so much rejection in show business, I was very good at being menacing. The one thing that all the young actors could do was play rage and menace, because that's what they felt. We were so shut out all the time that you could only say when they didn't want you, thank you very much. You could never really express all this frustration. So a lot of us were good villains.
Have you ever heard overheard conversations about your looks in terms of whether you would have made it as a good leading man?
You know, I try to get into these rooms where they're having these meetings so I can overhear what they're saying, but they usually catch me. You know, like even today, if I'm out in Hollywood, I try to get around the back door of a studio to see if I can overhear some conversations about my looks. But it's hard to get in there to overhear them.
Mm-hmm. My guest is actually...
What do you mean? Where would I go to overhear conversations about my look? Are they having them somewhere? You mean, would you put that a different way?
I see your point.
Yeah.
Right.
Have you ever overheard anything about how much money you have? No, I've never overheard anything about that. Have you ever overheard anything about your weight? Yes, I did overhear the other day. My wife and my daughter were talking about, is he fat or what? No, he's not, just the way he's standing. I overheard that.
Well, I figure there's some things casting directors discuss in front of you and some that they don't, but things that you find find out anyways whether they discuss it in front of you or not. And people have to be discussing, well, I don't know, is he handsome enough for this
there
role?
Was a, yeah, they discuss everything. And, you know, one of the blessings is that you don't hear all the things that they're saying. I mean, I have an agreement with the people that represent me, is I really only hear if they want me. I mean, they definitely know not to call me every day and tell me all the things that they don't want me for. You know, right. That movie with Paul Newman, that one with Clint Eastwood, that one with Ryan O'Neill and Robert Redford, they don't want you for that. Thanks for being in touch. Thanks. And there's one coming up they want Jack Nicholson for. They don't want you for that. Oh, good. Good. Like, good to know that. You know. And Michael Keaton, that Batman thing, they wanted him. They didn't want you. Oh, really? Yeah, I kind of assumed it when I saw the movie because we hadn't heard anything about it. Yeah, well, they definitely didn't want you. They didn't want you for the Nicholson part in that either. Right. Okay, good. Well, thanks. I like to hear all this. No, I don't. I really try to not to think about it. That's why I think I spend so much time thinking about sports.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm afraid of what I might think about.
Well, how did you get from being like the bad guy and auditioning for action series to specializing in comedy, which it seems is what you've done over the past few years?
Well, I was really trained as a serious actor, and Elaine May, really with the Heartbreak Kid, knew me socially, and it just was intending to star me in whatever movie she was going to direct. She just felt that she had this guy that she was going around telling everybody how good I was, and everybody said, if he's that good, why don't we see him? And he says, well, when he has a chance, you will see it. But show business is so much about opportunity that, you know, as I've said, if Dustin Hoffman hadn't been The Graduate, nobody would know what he was doing, because he was about heading out of the acting profession around that time. He was really, he had actually done some off-Broadway shows, but just before that, he had about given it up. And I really lost interest in it, too, right around 1965. It just was too difficult. You could be in a success and not get anywhere. But I was really put into the Heartbreak Kid as a comedy player, and then totally perceived that way. Before that, it was just, you know, whatever you could do. I never wanted to be in a sitcom. I just didn't like that kind of rhythm playing. I was doing something different, and I wouldn't have fit in. So that's an extremely murky answer to your question.
Well, explain what it is that you feel like you do different from, for instance, the acting in a sitcom.
Well, a sitcom is based a lot on rhythm. There's a setup and there's a punchline, a setup and a punchline, and I don't really do that. I just basically try to be alive in a situation, and I'm not really wanting to do jokes. Most of the humor that comes out of me has nothing to do with a funny line. It has to do with just being there. So I'm not, somebody said to me once, do you practice these looks in front of a mirror? I don't even know what I'm doing. I just know that I'm alive there in the situation, and that's what, if you ever, when you saw Candid Camera, these people weren't actors, but they were alive in a situation, and they're normal, honest responses were funny, and that's basically what I'm doing. I've really been trained to be able to be as though I were in life on the screen, and that's what I'm basically doing, just existing there, and then whatever's going to come out of me. Now, you know, if somebody like who is not maybe a humorous person in life did that, it wouldn't necessarily come out funny. But if you took a person who was humorous in life and they could do that, it probably would come out.
My guest is actor Charles Grodin, and he's written an autobiography called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. So you're trained in the method. You studied with Uta Hagen and with Lee Strasberg. Do you feel like you use the method in doing comedy roles?
Well, and to the extent that basically what it is that I function as an actor the way I'm functioning right now. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm responding personally to you. That's basically at the heart of it. It's a personal response. Now, the difference is, these are not written lines that I'm saying to you now. Well, most everything I say is written. I actually wrote down all these things and hope you'd ask some of these questions. That's the difference. And then the skill is to be able to take the lines of the script and make it your own and make it come out of you naturally. But it's so you do apply it all the time.
When you were making Midnight Run with Robert De Niro, can you compare how you each prepared for your roles?
Well, in terms of the background of the part, Bob does a lot. He would like to live the life of the character. He actually went on drug bust with a bulletproof vest because his character did this kind of thing. Even though he didn't do it in the movie, this was part of being the character of Jack Walsh, who he played. I don't really do that. My focus is much more on what's going on right there at the moment. I just accept the fact that I'm an accountant who embezzled money from the mob and gave it to charity. I just accept that, and then I'm there with this guy. I just accept the situation, but I don't really go around embezzling money from the mob in preparation for the role.
So what kinds of differences does that make for when you're actually doing a scene together?
None whatsoever, because what he does is it just brings him to the point where he can be alive in the moment, and what I do brings me to the same point, that we're both doing the same thing. If there's one thing unique about us working together that I found different than a lot of other situations, that I believe in something I learned from Paul Muni in a book that Paul Muni wrote years ago, that you should, if you have a scene and say it's 3 pages long, for example, mm-hmm. you could learn those lines, but there's learning the lines and there's learning the lines. And I believe in learning the thing, so you could do it 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You could say, just as tools, that you could say these words so fast. So I believe in going over the thing and running it, just as the words, not how you're going to do it, not the interpretation, not the meaning, nothing like that. Just the tools, the words themselves. I would do that an unending amount of time to get it so solid with me that I know it just as quickly as I know the alphabet or counting to 10 or my own name. And Bob agrees with that. So we would sit there and maybe do that 100 times, which is a lot. I mean, it takes a very long time to run a 3-page scene 100 times, but there would be no limit, because he understood that once you do that and you go in front of the cameras, you're completely free to come alive and do anything. You're never thinking about your words. And too many actors, they think they've done the work, but they haven't done it. And it affects their work. And I've seen friends of mine, they say, what do you think? And I say, I don't think you know the lines well enough. And they say, no, I know them. I knew them at home. This is different, though. There's cameras. There's 50 people around. The distractions are tremendous. You've got to be so solid before you can really be free and be creative. And that's something I think he understands, and it's what I do, and it had a lot to do with the freedom you see in the playing.
When you shot the Heartbreak Kid, and you talked about that as being a kind of breakthrough role in comedy for you, you read for Neil Simon, he loved your performance, then you were reading for him again, but this time you thought you'd already gotten the role and you were doing what you describe as exploring the character.
Right.
And he hated your reading in this,
right.
And he wanted to fire you, which he didn't do. But can you describe what you were doing the second time around?
It's the difference between performing, which you sometimes, in that case, certainly had to do to get the part. And, you know, it might be something like this. I might say, Mr. So-and-so, I'd like to talk to you about your daughter. I really like her, and I'd really like to, you know, maybe you and I could talk, and I could, you know. Now, that's like actually talking to someone and trying to do something. But if you were just exploring, it might come out more like, Mr. So-and-so, I'd like to talk to you about your daughter. I like her. I've really met her. In other words, what I'm doing the second time is I'm kind of just letting the situation and the reality of what it is I'm talking about. It's a work process that I'm just trying to feel my way through it. I'm not trying to be effective. I'm just working on my own. But the mistake I did is you don't want to work on your own in front of Neil Simon. He'll think that's what you're going to do. In fact, Eddie Albert, I don't know if I mentioned that in the book, but he too said, is this the guy that's playing the part? You know, I think you kind of owe it to the writer until rehearsals start anyway to let them keep seeing you perform it. But since I'd already performed the whole script for him and actually did a screen test and performed it some more, I thought that they had already seen that, but I was giving them credit for more sophistication than they really had.
You played the first gynecologist in Rosemary's Baby, which was directed by Roman Polanski. And you tell a really funny and also very interesting story in your book about a pause that you wanted to put in a line. Would you tell that story and
yes.
explain the significance of the pause
yes.
to you?
Yes, Mia Farrow comes to me for help and says that she feels that these witches and demons, whatever it is, are pursuing her. And at the end of this long tale, which sounds insane to me as a doctor, I'm supposed to say, you may be right, and then I'm supposed to make some phone calls to help her. Well, I felt if she told me that whole story and I said, you may be right, the audience would say, like, well, why? It's very unlikely. He'd just believe that. So when she finished the story, I looked at her for a long time as though I was considering what she'd said, and I very slowly said, well, you know, you may be right. And then Roman Polanski, the director, leaped up and says, take out that pause. And I explained my point, that which I just made here. And he says, no, it's not more believable if you have a pause. It's less believable. So I really didn't agree with him. It was my first picture, and he was a famous director at the time, and I kind of did it with less of a pause. At the end of the day, I went up to him and I said, you know, Roman, I was thinking about what you said, what you told me this afternoon, and you know something? And then I took the longest pause you can imagine, and I said, I think you're right. He says, good, that's right, that's what I'm saying. I said, did you just believe me? He says, yes. I said, but I'm lying. That's what I wanted to do in the scene. And he looked at me, and he you could see he was trying to figure out whether he hated my guts or admired me. and he decided he admired me. He threw his arm around my shoulders. Come with me, watch the film from the previous day. And we go in, and the next day, after he had time to sleep on it, he realized that he hated my guts after all. And for the rest of the movie, I said, Roman, he said, I don't care what you do. No matter what I would want to ask. That's a European director. There's a problem with some of them. I haven't had that much experience with them, but they are more autocratic, just the same way, you know, certain men of other cultures are. They don't really believe in give and take. They believe more in you take, they give.
Well, this must be a constant source of anguish for an actor deciding whether you should go with your own intuition on how to play something or go with the director's advice.
It doesn't really come up for me. My relationship with directors that I work with, and it's been true for several years, is I like them to see what I'd like to do. If they don't like it, that's fine. But I don't really have that was a unique problem. Generally speaking, I can't really think offhand of anyone asking me to do something that I thought was inappropriate. There was a play I was in once where they wanted me to, when the woman opened the door, they wanted me to fall into the room as though I was leaning against the door. And I said, gee, I really would rather not do that. And the director said, I know that's going to get a laugh. I said, well, I know it's going to get a laugh from some people in the audience too, but it's going to really take away the credibility that this is an actual person. It will look like an actor doing a bit. And he took my point, and I didn't do it. I mean, when people say they got a laugh, and you hear performers say this sometimes, they count it a laugh if somebody laughs. But if you have 800 people in an audience and three people laugh, I consider like 797 people were just bored by what you did. That's not a laugh. So the demands that I put on what's a laugh are different. But generally, if my understanding with directors now is I will have things to say, I'll like to try this and do this and whatever, and you be in charge and you choose and you make the judgment, and all I want you to do is to see it. And it works very well that way. Everybody, as long as it's very clear that they're in charge, the director is comfortable, and I'm comfortable because he has to be in charge. I don't want to try to be in charge. If I'm in charge, then I'll be in charge. But essentially, it's the director who's in charge.
There have been times when you were unable to stop yourself from laughing. You tell the story in your book of when you were playing with Ted Knight, who played Ted Baxter, the newsman on the Mary Tyler Moore Show,
in a
soap opera, an afternoon soap opera, and you had a lot of scenes together, and every time you'd be on the set together, you would just break up. Was that because of the knowledge of the absurdity of the whole program?
Well, we were very good friends off screen, and we really had a lot of laughs off screen, but the real problem was that we were playing, as you do in many soap operas, a variation on one scene, and the scene was that he was my boss, and I would constantly come in and ask him if Irene Forsythe, who was my mother-in-law in the show, the character's name was Irene Forsythe, if she had anything to do with me getting my job here at Forsythe Industries, which of course she did, you know. And this scene, we must have played this scene, I don't know what, a dozen times over a period of time. So when I'd come in and I'd say, you know, can I have a word with you? Yes, Matt, what is it? Did Irene Forsythe have anything to do with me getting my job here at Forsythe Industries? Now, Matt, we've discussed this before. And, you know, and we had discussed it many times. And Ted kind of used like an English accent on the show. Oh, Matt, I don't think this is anything we should be discussing. And we couldn't do it. We just couldn't do it. I mean, here we, you know, like 2 weeks later, Ted, can I have a word with you? Yes, Matt, what is it? I just was thinking this afternoon, and I was wondering if, did Irene Forsythe have anything to do with me getting my job on Forsythe? Now, Matt, we couldn't do it. We just like look at us. Oh, please don't ask me this question again. Yes, she got your job. You stink. You couldn't get a job on your own. All right, leave me alone. You know, but we never said that. We just kind of like made it another scene. But the hardest time I ever had in a movie is something I didn't write about in the book, but you could almost see it in the movie of The Heartbreak Kid when I have a showdown scene with Eddie Albert, and he tries to buy me away from marrying Sybil Shepherd, and I somehow get into a speech about how I was in the service and during the war, and that I, to show what a tough guy I am, I say, you know, when I was in the armed forces of our country, and I fought every moment for 3 years, and I fought every moment of those 3 years, and the line in the script was, not overseas, unfortunately, because of a minor back condition. And I couldn't get through that scene because I was so, you know, I fought for our country for 3 years. Not overseas, unfortunately, because then I couldn't get through it. And even now, if you look at the movie, you'll see, like, at that moment, I'm, like, staring at the floor, like, biting my tooth off. You know?
You said that sometimes you tell a joke with such a straight face that people take you seriously. Has that gotten you into any trouble recently?
I think it's always gotten me into trouble. It's something I've tried to rectify. I don't know. I mean, I make an assumption about things sometimes that what I'm saying is so absurd it couldn't possibly be taken seriously. But, you know, people read expression more than they do content. And I've learned that, and I really don't like that. I mean, I really don't like to mislead people or to fool people or anything like that. I mean, and it's happened many times. In fact, you know, many people, you know, have been uncomfortable. I remember Warren Beatty, who's a pretty smart guy, saying to me, I don't know what if you're kidding or not. Well, when he said it to me, it really struck me because he's very quick. He's a very hip guy, and if he couldn't tell, then, you know, what am I trying to do? I'm not trying to put something over on people. I'm trying to amuse people. If they really don't know what I'm doing, then I have to do something differently. And I have in recent years attempted to not have that happen.
So you don't do that anymore?
No, I really try not to do it. I mean, I can still fumble into it. Yeah. I remember the first time I met Elaine May, she came in and said, Gene Wilder says such wonderful things about you. And she being Elaine May and such a famous comedic person, I said, boy, you're really coming on to me, aren't you? She was so embarrassed. It was so tense, you know. And it wasn't until like later in the afternoon that she started to see, oh, I was kidding around. But I really am very careful. I can't resist it sometimes. But in a speech, I followed Jean Simons, Senator Paul Simons' wife, in a speech in Pittsburgh, and I said that I had directed in 1969 the only television special with Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, Tell Him I Said Hello. You know, that I could do because I figured, like, everybody knew that was a joke, you know.